Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children. Angry mobs are trying to tear down statues of our founders, deface our most sacred memorials, and unleash a wave of violent crime in our cities. Many of these people have no idea why they are doing this, but some know exactly what they are doing. They think the American people are weak and soft and submissive.
That was President Donald Trump giving his State of Our Disunion at Mount Rushmore on Friday as the nation prepared to celebrate arguably its weirdest Independence Day since Nick Gillespie was approximately 12 years old. Hello, patriots. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by the aforementioned hair model for men. You people don't have any idea. Plus last week's host, Peter Suderman. Thank you, Peter. And Reason editor at everything, Catherine Mangue Ward. Heidi ho, everyone.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
So one of the best things about being on vacation, which I was last week, is that all the stuff that makes news, or at least causes the news people to talk excitedly amongst one another, is all sort of muffled, like the teacher lady in the Peanuts cartoons.
Also what you hear when I talk, I know. So
yeah, what's those fingers? There's just like the
she doesn't talk with her fingers, Matt.
Yeah, I do.
You haven't seen the things I have seen. Anyways, my sense of the 4th of July compared to the sense of what people were screaming at each other on the 4th of July felt like the two Americas that John Edwards warned us about. So, Catherine, since you live in D.C., was your 4th of July just filled with like Trump pinatas and people trying to rewrite Frederick Douglass poems? Or did you sit on goat farms and light off bottle rockets like a normal person?
I am super mad at you for reminding me of John Edwards' presidential campaign.
Speaking like of hair model for men, I mean, actually, Nick is rocking the Edwards right now.
Yep. Hair models. I had definitely memory hold that one. So thanks. No, I was a good American. I, you know, seared proteins on a grill. There were flag items strewn about my house. I did the thing. So no Trump pinatas were sighted. And because I spent my 4th of July with small children, they were mostly just mad that the municipal fireworks did not go as planned, since I had told them they were allowed to stay up and see them this year.
Oh.
So thanks, coronavirus.
Oh, that's rough. Nick, I presume you just kept 1776 muted on your TV while tripping balls on peyote and listening to Philadelphia Freedom.
Oh, yeah.
John?
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Billie Jean King was my designated driver over the weekend, Matt. So it was really just kind of a wonderful thing. Now I'm in the Bay Area, and we were with my girlfriend, and we were staying at her parents' house, which is in Piedmont, California, and had a fantastic view of, I guess, Oakland and the Bay Area, like across into San Francisco. And the two things I did, both of which were kind of uplifting. One, we watched on Disney Plus the stream, or there was a recording from 2016 of Hamilton, which it was a better play, I must say, than 1776, as much as I love John Adams from 1776. And Ben Franklin, who had been a blacklisted actor during the McCarthy years. So we watched Hamilton, which was great. And, is a common text that I think people can get around, or at least theater types. But more interesting to me was all fireworks were banned by Governor Newsom, who is far more of a dictator, Matt, than Jerry Brown was. Governor Jerry Brown in California, Uber Alice. But you could see from where we were just decentralized, dispersed fireworks displays of pretty intense magnitude all over the Bay Area. And it was kind of It was kind of beautiful in its own way. It was like, you know, everybody was having a 4th of July as they saw fit or not to. And so that was my ringing in the 4th. And it was nice.
If you haven't seen it, people of the internet, go and look at there's like July 4th evening aerial cam footage of Southern California, LA, where everyone was just sort of like, it's like it's like the beginning of Apocalypse Now, just like it's incredible, or the end of Fight Club, or
so
something
it's
like
beauty.
That.
Beauty, it's really, it's beauty, right at
except
that
for,
river's
for
end.
Fun and yeah. To not destroy things.
Yes,
right. And as somebody who worked as a municipal lifeguard, where we in my hometown of Middletown, New Jersey, where we would have our town fireworks, and one year they all exploded at once, which was spectacular. But I'm against, nice. You know, if it's yep. as bad as it
that's
is,
that's the grand finale. That's
yeah,
just what
no,
the
this,
grand finale
it was,
is.
It was all
the grand
one
beginning,
thing.
Too, I think is the
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, it was the whole enchilada. It was pretty great. But, you know, I hate when the, you know, when fighter jets, the Blue Angels or whoever fly over football games or anything. That's money out of the taxpayer's pocket. Municipal fireworks are an incredible waste of time and energy and money. Let the people do it, and we're all better off.
I was
it's like school choice for fireworks.
I was informed, Nick, by WNYC that those flyovers actually don't cost any money because that's just normal training.
Yeah.
Time
no, that's true.
That would have had. Yeah. So it's
that's like wars don't money. Cost any money. The wars don't cost any money because, you know, we're paying those people anyway. So
I just want to say wars don't cost Eddie money because that's more 70s even than your hair. Peter, what kind of twee cocktails did you make for your 200-pound dog for the 4th of July?
I made a jungle bird and a which is a great sort of a it's a bitter rum pineapple cocktail. It's kind of almost like a cross between a Negroni and like a Mai Tai or something, but weirder. And so that's my favorite tiki drink. So I definitely made one of those. Made Thomas Keller's fried chicken recipe in my backyard and sat out there with my wife and could hear that my block is a real intense July 4th block. And I've lived here for 10 years now, and the neighbors just start playing music around 4 o'clock. It's super loud. Like everybody's grilling. Like there's just sort of, it's actually kind of great. Like it's not like a big block party where everybody's hanging out together so much as everybody's just doing their own things in their backyards and sort of enjoying being out and around together, which was especially nice this year. But this year, we got a show put on by our president and our military. The flyovers that you were complaining about flew directly over my house. It felt like about 20 feet over my house. I'm sure it was higher than that, but I actually got to see a B-2 stealth bomber in the air for the first time in my life.
Wow!
Like just flying over my backyard. I got to see the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds, both of whom I have seen in the past because I grew up in Florida and they would sometimes practice over my middle school. But I'd never seen them fly together, and they flew in a double formation over my house. And you know what? Like, I was thinking about this. It's bad. I don't support this. Like,
I was going to say, there better be a
to
be sure
them.
Coming here.
To be clear, like, I totally agree with Nick. Like, this sort of, like, martial fanfare, you know, at taxpayer expense is a bad idea. At the same time, I like cool, expensive machines and toys. And I just like they're neat and they're neat to watch in action. And for a moment, like I joked to Catherine, as this was happening, hey, I'm a nationalist now. These things are awesome. But I was actually, I was sort of thinking about this. I looked at that and I thought for a moment, actually, I can kind of, I now like have a glimpse into the appeal of a certain kind of nationalism where for like, and not that, again, this is not that I actually am like, oh, I'm actually a nationalist now. I'm not, but it's actually a hard thing for me to understand most of the time. It's like, because it's not like a sense that I normally have, but looking at those things fly over, I was like, wow, that's really cool. Those are neat, neat toys. And I sort of understood that like a bunch of the appeal for probably more for dudes, for a certain type of dude, is just that, like, the toys are neat, and there is just like a kind of, right, it's like these
military places. Be clear, gadget based nationalism is on the Y chromosome. Like, right. there are lady nationalists, but not because of that.
But it's related to
gender, is not real, et cetera. Sorry.
It's related to rockets. It's related to space. It's related to all of that sort of thing. And then, you know, we went just down the block where I can see the fireworks show on the mall. And it like lights up the silhouette of the Washington Monument. But in Washington, D.C., the amateur fireworks are so incredible and so intense, and they are set off not quite on every block, but every couple of blocks. And so just all around you, in the midst of a city, an urban environment, you just see stuff that you cannot believe is anybody could have purchased without like a professional fireworks license. The shows that they put that come from the neighborhoods come very close to rivaling, or feel like they come close to rivaling, in part because of the proximity, the show that is put on down by the mall. And that show, the amateur shows in the neighborhood go on until midnight or 1 a.m. And then leave a pretty incredible pile of ordnance the next morning everywhere.
I just like it when Peter, for moments, gets close to like glimpsing what it's like to be a normal American. And tries to describe it.
Like, yeah, that was awesome. Peter was like, here's the thing. I think I might have an idea.
Matt, guys, you know, the...
if you have a B-2 stealth bomber, it's like this giant triangle thing. And the thing that I had never understood before, I was always like, okay, so I understand how it evades radar, right? That's just a sort of, it's basically in the design, in the shape of it. The radar pretty much goes around it, can't see it. But what I hadn't understood was that even in person, even when this gigantic freaking thing is flying directly over you, unless you are pretty much right under it, it's so thin that you don't really see it. And when it goes off into the distance, it basically just looks like a bird because it's just a little squiggle. And so it is actually stealth in the air to your eyes.
Matt, I was going to say, you know, the and I did this myself as I was beginning, even as Peter was talking, getting amped up about military hardware. I think if we forced people to listen to Bo Donaldson in the Haywoods, Billy, Don't Be a Hero.
Oh, yeah.
We would never enter a war again. This was a top. It had to be like a top 10 hit sometime in the 70s. It is the anthem of the Hollow Army. It's a retelling of a Civil War recruit who goes, dies, and his fiance throws away the letter from the president saying that her fiance had been a hero. Wonderful, wonderful song. I want that America back, minus the double-digit unemployment and inflation, race war, oil shortages, and general malaise.
Hey, we've got plenty of oil. Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah, now we have more oil than we know what to do with now. So,
speaking of
but we also have more militarism.
Speaking of energy independence, I thought that on this Independence Day, and not only because it's a pure podcasting gimmick, but also it might be a way of thinking about that glorious, mostly glorious Enlightenment document from 244 years ago. Don't read the stuff about the merciless Indian savages, but it's totally in the same declaration. But I thought it might be interesting for all of us to go around the round table and discuss what we think that we all, America should at least, or whoever, should declare independence from anew. Catherine, you're a lady. Why don't you go first? What should America declare independence from in this horrific year 2020?
So I'm ready to declare independence from the idea of getting back to normal, from the return to normalcy as a goal. And this is like real, real macro, like maybe too macro for this answer. But Joe Biden is this, right? He's campaigning on the idea of getting things back to normal. And you know what? That's going to suck. If Joe Biden wins and gets things back to normal, it's going to suck because Joe Biden sucks and American politics sucked. And people going to bars too soon is this, and not wearing masks too soon is this. We got to get back to normal because there's something inherently good about normal. And if we do it, then everything else will fall into place. No, we gonna die. Police brutality and associated issues is this. There's a lot of people who want to get back to normal where people aren't in the streets furious about this incredible miscarriage of justice, this horrible law breaking as a matter of routine that is ordinary police conduct in much of the country, much of the time. No, normal was bad there. We got to undo the normal. You know, college and K through 12 school. I don't want to get back to normal. I'm done now. I wanted to get back to normal. I'm done with that now because they sucked. They were broken. They weren't working. We were asking them to perform 8 different functions wedged together in a single institution. It's all busted up now anyway. Now is a good time to not get back to normal. And this is like a late breaking realization for me because I'm a pretty, despite my radical politics, I guess, like I'm a pretty conventional and sort of even keeled, contented type person. I guess I'm also like a privileged white lady. So normal has worked for me. Like, even though all these things are bad when you think about them individually, normal's been fine for me. But now normal is over and it's not going to go back the way it was. And it shouldn't go back the way it was because normal sucked. So,
wow.
Independence from the new normal, or we want the new normal, independence from the old normal.
So, Catherine, when you talked about the flags in your yard, that sounds like you were raising the pirate flag, the anarchist flag.
That's
the
right.
Black flag.
I hung those babies upside down.
Fact check. Joe Biden tweeted, I believe, yesterday or sometime recently that after he wins the election in November, then it's time to transform America. So maybe Biden
he has changed
is
his
your
campaign.
Agent of change after 50 years of being an advertisement for hair plugs. Speaking of someone who does not need such things, Nick, you co-wrote a book called The Declaration of Independence. What do you think that we should declare independence?
I also co-read it as well. I found that I couldn't, just as I couldn't write it by myself, yeah. I couldn't read it by myself. I needed at least a couple of helpmates on that. So I'm declaring independence from experts, but not expertise. And these two things are linked. When I say I'm declaring independence from experts, what I mean is that we live in an age where, you know, and to some degree this has always been the case, but there's no question that experts now are so obviously politicized and interested parties in the things they're talking about that it's hard to take experts, you know, seriously anymore. I think epidemiology is in the barrel right now. We saw this where epidemiologists, sometimes the same person flipped from saying, don't go outside, you're going to kill people, to when it became, when going outside and protesting fit their political agenda, they were like, oh, well, you know what? Like, if you go out and protest for George Floyd or Black Lives Matter, it's okay. You know, it's not really going to be a super spreader event. If you do the same thing and you walk on the steps of the Michigan State Capitol with your mullet and your beer gut, that's a big problem and we got to shut it down. So experts should be held in not quite contempt, or what I'm arguing is like we can no longer accept experts just dissertating from on high. And what we need is expertise. And this is something where it's been devolved down to the individual, like so many other things in our lives now, where we have to suss through people and find out who are the good experts and the bad experts. And so I'm declaring independence from experts, but I'm backing expertise. And the type of expert that I'm finding, and this is always a work in progress, I want to point people to a tweet storm from Carl T. Muth, who teaches law and economics at Northwestern University, who over the weekend put up a phenomenal long infra-rich tweet storm about how air marshals since September 11, 2001, have more air marshals have been arrested than people have been arrested by air marshals. And 3,000 men and women who are air marshals cost about $870 million annually. And then they get arrested at higher rates than average for all sorts of crimes, such as drunken disorderly conduct, domestic assault, and whatnot. These are the experts we have now. We have to find them. We have to meet them where we find them.
Peter, I'm sure you can make your independence declaration have something to do with Medicare or the Congressional Budget Office. Go.
Yeah, no. When you first posed this, writing prompt on Slack, I thought initially that it was just about us personally. And so the two things that came to mind first was pants. And I'm declaring independence from pants.
Yep.
So your thing is the same as my thing.
Because I work from home. It's 90 degrees. Who cares? Shorts are more comfortable. I'm wearing some right now. They've got drawstrings. I've gotten a couple of pairs of drawstring shorts. And it's 90 degrees out. I'm pants are canceled. The second thing was Twitter. And I have just about had it with Twitter. As some people here know, as I've said before, I've been frustrated with it increasingly for many years. I don't know if I'm going to quit entirely, but I'm very ready to do so. And I'm looking for ways to do so and seeing if that could work for me. But I actually think that both of those things are also what America should declare independence from. Pants and Twitter. People need to stop caring about what other people think about them. And I'm serious about it. Like, be comfortable. Don't worry about what other people, like, about how you look, about what other people are thinking or saying about you. And get offline and stop arguing about stuff on Twitter. It's bad for you. It's bad for the country. It's bad for your mental health. Go read a book, wear gym shorts, and sit in your backyard.
Wait a second. You said declare independence from pants. That doesn't mean declaring new affinity for gym shorts, Peter. I think those we can all recognize those are separate concepts.
Oh, you said drawstring shorts, which...
I'm currently not wearing gym shorts, but if you want to wear gym shorts, I am giving you permission on this podcast today. Declare independence from pants. Declare independence from Twitter. America, just stop, like, chill out for a little while.
Peter, I have a question. In your new regime, when America follows the Peter program, I recently bought my son a pair of those old man adventure pants that you can zip off the bottoms of, and then they become shorts.
Wow.
Because as we have discussed previously on this podcast, we're outdoorsy now. Where do those fit in the pants, no pants typology? Because they're kind of both.
Those pants are literally, they embody the transformation that America needs. America needs to just rip off the bottoms of their pants and turn them into shorts.
Okay.
How do dogs wear those pants, Catherine? Do they wear them on all four legs on the bottom or just on the hind legs?
That's a question that I am not well equipped to answer.
My dog's more of a t-shirt wearer.
True fact about my wife. Almost 20, definitely 23 years ago this month, at our wedding, her wedding dress had the little cutaway and became a wedding skirt when it was dancing time, which is pretty cool. I'm going to declare my own, not my own, but I'm going to suggest as a declaration of independence something that's kind of overlaps with what Nick was saying, which is specifically to the institution of the New York Times, but also to the idea that there are these kind of legacy media institutions who we can trust to literally mediate that expertise of which Nick was talking about. And there's a couple of different things that are swimming around in my head having to do with this. One is, which Robbie wrote about 8-10 days ago. By the way, Peter Sudeman doesn't exist on Twitter right now, from this morning. That account doesn't exist, from what I understand, or at least clicked on earlier. But anyways, the New York Times was set to publish a profile. I don't know if it's been published because I was on vacation, of Scott Alexander, Slate Star Codex, a very interesting, like, kind of rationalist type of blogger, and he and they were going to out his name because Scott Alexander, I think, is his first and his middle name, but not his last name. He's a practicing, I think, psychotherapist or something along those lines. And so he just deleted his account, and this led to a lot of discussion, and then also kind of a set of contretemps between the New York Times tech writers and Silicon Valley people, who started saying, hey, look, the New York Times at this point is a weapon against us. It's not necessary or advisable to do business with them when they come knocking on your door. They are trying to, you know, they're probably trying to do something bad to you. You know, usually if you think about a large newspaper coming to your company wants publicity regardless. And this actually went to a friend of mine, was solicited for comment on related stories. And he's just like, oh, nope, I'm, you know, not worth it. It's interesting when you start, when you stop treating those institutions as like someone that you have to play ball with. And kind of this might seem unrelated, but somehow it isn't. And this is all in the wake of the various, you know, Tom Cotton flaps and internal struggles over the New York Times. We got our vacation hold. The newspaper stopped, and I'm holding this up to the camera here. This is the Sunday review section of the of the New York Times.
Matt, we're this is a podcast, Matt.
It's 2020. 2020, Matt.
No, but
you're holding
I
up newspapers from the 90s.
Okay,
I want my colleagues to see the beautiful socialist realist art on the Sunday review section on a thing called The Economy We Need. And I will read just from the opening paragraph here. The annual economic output of the United States has almost tripled, but with the help of policymakers from both political parties, the wealthy hoarded the fruits. This is the opening gambit. The whole section is about how we should cancel black debt. Banks should do that. You should give up your white privilege. They just went full New York Times. And like, one has, especially one of a certain age, this thing in your mind, like, this is the paper of record. This is that. This is the other. And it's like, no, actually, what you should listen to people who claim to want to be kind of weaponizing the discourse and the way that we talk about policy and economics, and like, leave it behind, man. I'm declaring independence from the New York Times. Goodbye. Let's go to a caller. Dubuque. Just kidding.
You just did like Rush Limbaugh just possess your body for a minute?
Larry King, man. Back in the old day.
Oh, that was supposed to be Larry King. Okay, okay.
But no, I want to get back to the clip that started this this rambling podcast program that we've been engaging in here, which was Trump's Rushmore speech. Sadly, I'm not referring to the movie, which is better than his speech. But it was sort of an American Carnage 2.0 2020 update. Nick, you love Joe Biden about as much as I love Boston sports fans. And yet you have noted a contrast between kind of Joe Biden's incremental uplift, thinking about July 4th, and Trump's sort of dark howling night of the soul. Do you want to talk a little bit about the contrast that you saw, or how this plays in with the presidential race in 2020?
Well, you know, one of the things that's you know, becoming clearer, or attempting to become clear, is Trump is pushing, and I think his Mount Rushmore speech was actually pretty powerful. It was declarative, and it set out a vision of kind of holding on to a status quo that is less and less, I think, representative, certainly, and probably popular as well. You know, the way in the, and you, I mean, everybody, you obviously can read the speech or watch it, but the clip at the beginning of the show really kind of, you know, that's the whole thing. And I think he makes some decent points there. He's right that there are people who are trying to destroy or just deny a particular understanding of culture and history in the United States, and they're going to do that by any means necessary. Joe Biden, in a video that he released over the weekend, offered up a different, and I think ultimately a more compelling vision of America, which was one saying that we had these ideals, we've never lived up to them, and we've got to start trying to do that, and we can do that together. Where each of these guys, I think, kind of loses me ultimately is that it's kind of, you know, it seems to me that we should be, the starting point should be that our past and our history and thus our future is always contested and up for grabs. And then it's what are the, you know, what are the principles that govern a good America versus a bad America? And then what does that mean when, you know, over the weekend, we were talking about this before we started recording, a statue in Rochester, New York, Frederick Douglass went missing. And it's not clear what happened to it, you know, whether it was white nationalists or Black Lives Matter people who didn't understand what was, you know, who Frederick Douglass was. But, you know, the question is how do we talk about our history and how do we hash out a common history that will actually unite us and allow us to move forward as opposed to simply gainsay one side or the other, which, you know, Matt, the Times thing you're talking about is a good example of that. Like, what, you know, that's one way of talking about history. Trump, you know, basically saying that anybody who says anything negative about freaking NASCAR or the Confederate flag is an iconoclast that can't be countenanced. So I think Biden has good rhetoric in that video that he put out, but then there's no guidance there. And to say that kind of thing without commenting on whether or not it's a good idea to pull statues down or paint Miguel Cervantes statues in blood or, you know, in fake blood, you know, what's the process here and what, how do we talk about what's good or bad about the future?
Peter, is Trump kind of making a similar, very online mistake that Biden's Democratic rivals did during the primary? Like, I mean, yes, crazy stuff's happening all over the country. The Frederick Douglass statue, you got to be kidding me. There's been, you know, there's a lot of boy that escalated quickly, memes and GIFs all over the place. People in their workplaces are suddenly being subject to struggle sessions that they thought before was only in academia and whatnot. But yet, it's not as if the world is a pitched struggle between Antifa and patriots on every street corner. And so in Trump, in sort of pitching it like this, is he mistaking the kind of excited chatter of his base online with the lived experience of the real America, of which Peter Suderman is obviously plugged into, as evidenced by his newfound love for patriotic gadgets?
I mean, that really sounds like a conclusion, that, you know, dressed up as a question to me.
Yep. And we're playing Jeopardy now.
I think it's basically right. A few years ago, I used to make jokes on Twitter.com about how the future of politics was just memes battling. And like, I thought it was, this was like when politicians using memes was a new thing. And I thought it was kind of ridiculous. But no, now that's our reality. Our reality is now just Twitter memes are now all politics. And all the statue politics, that's basically just Twitter memes in real life. That is Twitter memes that have become manifest in the real world and have taken over politics and then echo back into our political discourse on Twitter. And Trump, more than even a lot of very online activists, more than other politicians, is a creature of the internet, in particular a creature of Twitter. He is personally, clearly, just online all day. He needs to get off Twitter more than I do. And just like stop wearing pants.
Oh my God.
Dolphin
shorts for President Trump.
No, thank you.
Gym shorts, right? God. Gym shorts, drawstring shorts for Trump. This is a real thing that has happened. The political discourse has become so Twitter focused and so much of it happens on Twitter that mentality and that style of argumentation and thinking has taken over the rest of real world political discourse. And it is true that a lot of Trump's fans and supporters, his most hardcore, they love his tweets. They sort of like this mode of political engagement. They really do care about the symbolism and sort of the narrative, stuff that comes out of all this sort of statue politics. And so he is making a play to appeal, to sort of engage his most hardcore supporters there. One that I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know. I'm sort of unclear about whether I think it makes a lot of sense. But it is, I think, a thing that is a trend that I think is not good for American politics is that mode of just sort of pure attack symbolism, right? Of just kind of turning everything into an easily digestible kind of snarky meme has made politics much worse. And Trump is probably the most prominent exemplar of that mode of politics in America today.
Catherine, refuse to go back to normalcy and don't like that sort of selling proposition of or implied selling proposition of Joe Biden. But didn't Democrats kind of like, just from a purely strategic point of view, can I say this? Yes. Defang Donald Trump's punch here.
you can't say that.
In this sense, like Trump.
Does the punch have teeth?
When
if you have teeth growing out of your knuckles.
No, which is to say, like, Trump wants to run against Antifa. He would love to be running against Beto O'Rourke right now and Julian Castro and whoever was like trying to outwoke one another during the primary. And he's just not. He's running against like old guy. Who everyone remembers from back when he was doing all the really terrible policies in the 90s and before and after and during. But it's just like, it's just Joe Biden.
Also in the 80s. And in the
70s. And especially at a time of, as Nick mentioned before, double digit unemployment, terrible, terrible national debts and dead bodies piling up all around.
I mean, he obviously wishes he was running against someone different, but luckily he can run against a cartoonish stereotype of the protesters. And so that's what he's doing right now. He doesn't want to run against Joe Biden, so he's not gonna. And I think, you know, in that clip that we played at the top of the show, he characterizes his opponents as either A, dupes, right? He says, well, some people don't know what they're doing, or B, basically evil villains, right? Like just people who are mindlessly out to destroy things that are manifestly good. And I think, you know, this ties into, Peter's Twitter declarations and a bunch of other things, including Matt's, which is there's been a particularly bad round of there are two kinds of people, reasonable people like me, and incomprehensibly evil others with whom we must have no truck. And both sides are saying it about the other side. And this is, you know, if I have a hobby horse that I'm going to ride off into the sunset someday, it is that it just cannot be true that people who disagree with you are on average evil, like straight up really bad evil people. The country is very divided about politics and policy.
That's the sort of thing that an evil person would say, Catherine.
And it's not. Evil people would monologue about their evil plans to destroy Mount Rushmore. On Twitter, we had this conversation about this weekend about if you are a liberal, do you have any conservative friends? And it was this huge blow up around that concept in which many, many people said, no, of course I don't have conservative friends. They want to kill me. Anybody who doesn't share my basic liberal or progressive politics literally wants me to die. And there were hundreds, maybe thousands of tweets in my, you know, in the threads in my feed this weekend of people saying that over and over. And then you hear Donald Trump saying the same thing, but with the, you know, the photographic negative. And those people are wrong. Most people are perfectly nice, good people who are trying to do the best for themselves and people around them. And I don't understand why everyone wants so badly for their political opponents to be actually evil.
Nick, it would seems to me like you could easily make some political hay out of how weird this past like 6 weeks in the discourse has been, precisely because it is run into places in life where it normally has not. I mean, I gotten emails from people who serve in the military, and they're told to read the, you know, white fragility book suddenly, and like are asked to you know, given guidelines about what they're supposed to be able to say and not say, and when, what do you bring up and what do you not, and people are kind of terrified. So now this thing is has spread, and so it should be pretty easy to make a politics about that. And yet, as you mentioned before, or referenced before, Trump this morning tweeted against Bubba Wallace, NASCAR driver, and said that, you know, the other drivers in NASCAR were willing to sacrifice everything for him, meaning sacrifice flying the Confederate flag and using that kind of insignia. That and the flag decision has caused the lowest ratings ever. It's like the own goals here, as they say, across the pond, and probably here now, too. It's kind of remarkable, right? Like you don't have to. I mean, is there a winning national politics to defend the Confederate flag, for crying out loud, in 2020?
Yeah, I don't think so. But there is probably or potentially one to defend the past as more complicated than it's being given credit for. And I think this is where, you know, Joe Biden right now is not, you know, he is not an Antifa Black Lives Matter extremist pulling down statues, you know, across from the White House. But you can link him with that. And that's happening in the street. And I think that is going to freak out not just people who are actually interested in the Confederate flag, but a lot of other people in the middle who are like, are we just going to, you know, are we going to pour acid, you know, down our throats until it's just a skeleton and even the bones are kind of dried out and cracking and things like that. You know, I think Trump's, I ultimately, his
We're
vision
all gonna
of
end
America.
Up with knuckle fangs.
That's right. No fangs, no pants, and no normalcy. You know, Trump's vision of America is fundamentally wrong, you know, in my opinion. I think, you know, but equally the 1619 Project vision of America is also fundamentally wrong and mistaken. And that's the battle that Trump is trying to wage. Biden right now is stepping in as seemingly more moderate, but the fear of, you know, the fear with him is that he's an old man and he's going to be pushed into a closet in the Oval Office. And then, you know, people are going to be running rampant all over types of things. And when we, if, and this is a big if we actually get back to talking about anything related to policy, I remember Peter, I believe it was at Reason, wrote, you know, when Biden was running for president, he's talking about taxing far more and far more heavily than Hillary Clinton was in 2016. We're already in an America where, you know, what has the federal government spent so far in a 3-month period? You know, they've spent more, you know, they basically almost doubled the federal budget. We need to get back to these conversations. And I do think that Trump stirring this up, he's not fully making it up. There is a lot of mayhem and a lot of anger and a lot of iconoclasm on the streets that will probably rise to his bait and go even further.
Can we come back to the like national intelligentsia all getting super stoked about watching Hamilton this weekend? Like, I know many people have made this point on Twitter. I know that this is like a, you know, an already lukewarm take, but we are in the middle of pulling down statues of the founders, splashing them with blood, the 1619 Project. And it's the same people who were like, let's watch an all singing, all dancing review that elevates illuminates the beauty of the founders. And I know that it's supposed to be, okay, it's complicated, da, 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 and, you know, it shows them as humans. But I question the idea that, like, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda discovered that the founders were like complicated humans. And it's just, I know you can reconcile the two, but it just strikes me as so deeply bizarre that the same people who are out here being like, well, maybe it is okay to just like yank down statues of Thomas Jefferson and stomp on them are tuning in to watch these sort of very, very light, fun, you know, instantiations of the founders. And, you know, Nick, you mentioned 1776 earlier. Like, I think it's going to be interesting to see whether Hamilton turns out to be Les Mis or whether it turns out to be 1776.
Well,
like,
you
is
know,
this gonna,
here,
is it going to look
you
weird
get the
and
founders,
dated and bad?
You get the Broadway musical about the founders you need, right? And in 1776 actually debuted in the late 60s. And it was, you know, it was a way of kind of making the founders human in the wake of Vietnam and the credibility gap and looking forward to Watergate. The movie came out after Watergate. So, you know, it served a particular social function. I think Hamilton does a similar thing because it is about the founding. But it's, you know, it's mostly Black actors who are taking the role of people. There's very little policy. 1776 has a lot to talk about liberty and natural rights and things like that. Hamilton doesn't. There are nods to the, you know, how his banking genius supposedly saved the country early on, but it's mostly about personal drama and personal failings and personal, kind of honor and things like that. And it provides a space to kind of be proud or into the founding of a country that people might either want to have, preserve uncritically or kind of revisit. So I think that's the social function of Hamilton the musical. And I think it's a good one. It's a strong one. I don't know how popular it is ultimately. Very few people ever see a Broadway play and then, you know, seeing a Disney Plus stream. I don't know what that adds up to. But I think, you know, going back to something, Catherine, that you said and Peter said, like, we do need a different discourse, because if we go down the meme road, if we go down the Twitter road and the social media road, and Trump did not create that, but he exemplifies it. And so do people, many of his antagonists on the left and many of the people in the media. We need to figure out a different medium through which to talk about politics, for sure. And until we do that, it's just going to be two, knights in a Monty Python movie hacking limbs off of each other. And I don't know, you know, what I don't know what you do to use a mixed metaphor. I don't know what you do after the knights have somehow, they're feuding against each other and they've cut their legs off and their arms off. They're still alive and they're still arguing, but there's really nothing left to fight about.
This sounds like one of those, what do you call someone with no arms and no legs in front of your doorstep kind of jokes, which we'll just sort of leave and not talk about.
Okay.
I would like to make the following suggestion or interpretation regarding all this. I think the Hamilton Disney Plus thing shattered a lot of records. Like, a lot of people watch that stuff, and it's obviously been the most.
Yeah, but what does that mean? You know, is it Roots level? Is it MASH final episode?
Shush. Thank you.
Is it Sound of Music?
The sound of your mouth shutting up. Hamilton's the most successful Broadway play, tallest dwarf notwithstanding, just to go all the way everywhere. And it's also a huge Disney Plus thing. That is more popular, an act of creation, regardless of what you think of its of and any part of it. But this thing that was created, this art that was created, is more popular numerically, I would argue, than people who are tearing down Thomas Jefferson statues. Like, that's just actually not that popular. And it's not really a huge, schism. It's resoundingly more popular to create than to tear down. And the people who think that tearing down is going to be super awesome for them and for everybody, you got to build something that people are going to want to read, to look at, to enjoy, and whatever. And you're not, if that's just going to be all you try to care about and so forth. That is,
by the way,
segue.
You know,
that is,
if I may, Matt, yes. And you're rolling your eyes, people at home, Matt is rolling his eyes, but can we even have a discussion of replacing statues through kind of votes and things like that, or through political process rather than just tearing them down? Because it seems to me we've and Trump wants to traffic in this, that to remove a statue because you know, the people who put it up or the property it's on no longer think they want to have anything to do with it. You know, that's one thing. And that's very different than tearing down a statue in a public park or just yanking stuff down in the middle of a post-protest riot or looting spree. I mean, and these are like very elemental distinctions that we don't even seem to be interested in kind of, you know, trading in anymore, which I think is a huge part of the problem. And whether or not can Joe Biden say we should remove Confederate statues, but we shouldn't be tearing them down or lighting shit on fire. I think if he can say that, he's going to win the middle.
Let's transition to our end of podcast. What have you been consuming? Catherine, lead us off.
I am anticipatorily consuming something since I don't have it yet, but I just joined a Kickstarter to kickstart a fragrance called Ode to Space. And it's it's perfume that smells like space smells. I had read these articles that came out a couple years back.
Wait.
Where they?
How do you know what space smells like?
I'm gonna tell you. I read these articles that came out a couple of years back, which NASA had sort of done this project and asked astronauts to explain and kind of suss out what space smells like so they could use it for training. They wanted to make their training modules smell correctly so that everything would be as realistic as possible. And the answer to what does space smell like is some combination of burnt steak, raspberries, and rum. And tell me if that doesn't sound amazing. It does. And so these people who did this Kickstarter...
I'm going to make that cocktail.
Yeah, please do that. The people who did this Kickstarter used FOIA. They used the Freedom of Information Act to get from NASA their recipe for space smell. And now you can buy it. So I have just Kickstarted it to the tune of 2 bottles. I will be keeping one for myself and giving one to some other lucky space nerd when they arrive.
What's it cost?
To kickstart 2 bottles cost, I think, like $57 or something. So
I just want to say that this sounds like it was designed in a laboratory to make Catherine Mangu Ward give money to a Kickstarter campaign.
And it worked. It worked so well.
I really wish I had taken, more of a sample of Buzz Aldrin's smell or stench, Matt, when he spoke at a Reason event decades ago.
I don't want to smell like Buzz Aldrin.
What, want to smell like the second man to fake step on the moon, Catherine? What kind of patriot are you?
This is what I don't understand. Doesn't space, to the extent that humans can smell it, just smell like the recycled air full of astronaut body odor?
Correct. Let's not overread. Let's not overread this. This is, in fact, I think, this is a stretch in multiple directions. I also assume, given that they are selling this commercially, that they're at least going to make some effort to make it smell, if not good, at least interesting and not actively bad. And space might smell actively bad, to be clear. So there's a bunch of ways in which this is removed from reality, but it is a great interpretive effort to think about reality, and I am here for it.
Nick, what cultural products have you been consuming?
Speaking of smells, I have been consuming the new HBO series Perry Mason.
Worst segue ever.
Of course. Yeah, that segue smells worse than your space perfume is going to smell. No, I've been watching Perry Mason, the new HBO series. It's set in 1932 in Los Angeles. I'm excited, Matt, because that means the Olympics are probably going to play a role in it, the 1932 Olympics. Maybe you see some Buster Crab action going on. In any case, Perry Mason, for those of you who are of a certain vintage, will remember this as the bane of television reruns. Whenever you wanted to watch a cartoon, Perry Mason would be on as a lawyer played by a very doughy Raymond Burr, who won every case that he tried. In the new reboot, it's grittier. It's like Riverdale, taking the Archie kids and turning them into scumbags in an elite high school. Perry Mason is now a private detective in Depression era, pre-end of Prohibition LA. And it's gritty. It's Matthew Reese is the title character. He's best known for playing the husband, Philip, in The Americans. It's a great show. It's a dark, excellent so far. There's three episodes, a dark LA noir. And again, you know, it seems a lot of our popular culture is recurring back to stuff from the early 70s. And I think it makes sense where we have been in a long period of dispirited kind of national discourse, a lot of failures at the highest level of government and authority in other places. And so we're going through a kind of noir phase. And in the 70s, there was a huge look back to, you know, the olden days and revisiting that and revising them as much darker than we than kind of nostalgic entertainment would have. Perry Mason's in that. It's good. Worth watching.
Suderman?
I have been listening to the new album by the band, I believe it is pronounced Haim, Women in Music Part 3. It is a trio of sisters who play great funky 70s inspired rock and roll. Their new album is their best so far. It's just a sort of delightful kind of collection of like really smart, like they've talked about how they just really are like a rhythm trio and they just like interlocking rhythms. And that's a lot of what I'm into in music. Like I like sort of, I like when rhythm, complex rhythms that sort of move together. I'm much more interested in rhythms than I am in melody or in lyrics. And they're this great, just kind of groovy 70s inspired rock band that has like grown into doing into, you know, in some influence. They are now being influenced by R&B and by soul and by sort of all of these other kinds of interesting rhythmic music. It's a great rock album in a year of great albums. This is the one sort of area of pop culture that I'm super into that has not been decimated by the coronavirus has been music. And this has just been actually an astoundingly good year for new pop music, new rock, new hip hop, all that stuff. And there've been a bunch of really great albums. I think more so this year than in a long time, and this is one of them.
I watched the NBC July 4th fireworks special on July 4th because that's what you do. The music on that was really super great. This is not my pick, by the way, but just Peter talking about music. Like Brad Paisley was super good, and John Legend playing at St. Viviana's Cathedral in L.A. was just gorgeous. Way to go, team. That was actually a really good special overall. But my pick is going to be something that maybe we've talked about before, and I was nodding off, but I experienced it, so it changes everything, and that is the Oculus Rift. I put an Oculus Rift thing on my face. And I flew in space, Catherine. Oh, yeah. I met Darth Vader. Wow. I was sucked up on an Imperial cruiser and met like Darth Vader, and I was really bad at it, which is surprising.
Matt, how much do candy bars cost in your alternate reality?
$1 million. They're all $1 million bars. Okay.
I think we need to combine your experience with Catherine's Kickstarter
and
have the Oculus Rift, which only provides
Oculus
a sound
sniffed.
And visual experience.
Oh, no.
And then we can have the Oculus Sniff.
Just don't get John Waters anywhere near it is all I ask.
I will stand next to Matt while he like does his VR and just like spritz ode to space on him and everything will be great. And that's the future libertarians want.
People, I think Joanna Andreessen, our art director, who was in attendance, has already made a T-shirt of one of the more idiotic things that I said while like trying to deal with space and an Oculus Rift thing. So
what did you say?
Something like this is pretty neat, but I'm waiting for something to happen. I don't know, something along those lines, but even dumber. No, it's really cool. Camille Foster who showed it to me, and I think he's probably just taking all the drugs and spending all of his days on Oculus Rift because it's really the only sane thing to do in these times. Super great if you can afford you know the $5 trillion cost or whatever it is. Get your face on some of those goggles. That's pretty fun. That's all the face goggling that we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. You all missed me. I know it. Stay tuned for more podcasty goodness. Reason.com/podcast. including the Wednesday Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and more. And we will catch you back here next week. Put on those face goggles. Goodbye.